Você é pego, tio.
Ei, buenas.
Is this your stuff?
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Welcome, everyone. My name is Julia, I use her pronouns, and I work with program at Holden. And I'd like to introduce Justin, who will be sharing all around animal behavior this week. But today's session is on the locust journey. And Justin has spent a lot of time studying the brain, but also studying animals and animal behavior. Everything from mice and how they make sense of worlds around them to patterns of light and sound, how they may become meaningful signals in the brain that represent both objects, concepts, and ideas. He spent time studying the auditory system of European starlings and also has been instrumental in building the Brain Observatory in Seattle. He is passionate about building software for scientists and making science open, equitable, and accessible. So we are delighted to have you with us, Justin. Please welcome.
Awesome. Thank you so much for the introduction, too. Thank you all for having me. Very excited to chat with you all this afternoon. I hope that it's cool enough in here, and that if you need to take a nap, feel free. I hope that we can have a fun conversation today about locusts. As Julie noted, kind of a little bit about me. I have a PhD in neuroscience from UC San Diego. My research career focused on a number of areas, mostly in auditory and visual perception. Particularly, I spent a summer in undergrad studying sound localization in humans. Spent a good chunk of most of my PhD focused on sequence perception in European starlings. I did a little bit of work on motor coordination with zebra finches, and spent some time in Seattle studying visual change detection in mice. My PhD was a little bit of a diversion from a career, much more oriented toward social justice efforts initially. So during my undergrad, I spent some time helping to launch a couple of nonprofits. One focused on refugees and migration efforts, and the other one dealing with gender-based violence in Egypt. After my PhD and after spending some time at the Allen Institute for Brain Science, I shifted my focus toward building software and building software systems for scientists. So I currently work at a philanthropy called the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, where I work with a team of software engineers, designers, user experience researchers, and we're building a platform for microscopy and imaging to be able to help folks who are developing novel deep learning, machine learning methods for analyzing data to help them get them into the hands of biologists who need to be able to just point and click and get insights out of the data that they're collecting. In general, my current career is a little bit more focused on building tools that support open, collaborative, equitable, accessible science. If you catch me around Holden, happy to chat about any of that stuff too. So my goals for my sessions this week, and what I'm hoping that you're all able to kind of take away from this is first to just encounter some cool animal behavior. I think animals in the world around us do awesome and amazing things, and I think part of the privilege that I've had of being able to spend a good chunk of my career, learning about relatively obscure animals in much more depth than most people do, is to realize what rich, complex lives they lead, and even relatively simple animals are incredibly complex, and our understanding of how and why they're able to do the things they do we're just starting to scratch the surface. Another, my other goal is to help to embrace how the practice of research, both in the lab and the field together, bring a very holistic understanding of the world around us. There's a lot of science that can be done observationally, that can be done by going out and encountering nature directly. And that can be complemented by efforts in control spaces, in laboratories, where we can control all the parameters and really start to dig into cause and effect and see what's causing what. And so a little bit of what I'll be talking about each day, we'll touch on each of these. And then finally, at the end of this session, at the end of the week, I hope that you're just able to embark with curiosity and appreciation for the complexity of the world around us. And I'll also say too, as we go through and as we this talk, feel free to raise your hand, feel free to interrupt, feel free to ask clarifying questions. I would love for this to be as much of a conversation as we can make. So I suspect that with the topic of locus, especially at a place like Poland, what probably comes to mind is a very famous biblical story. As I was working on this talk, in the context of this story, there's a lot in here that is strikingly accurate. There's some things that are maybe less accurate, and we'll tease some of that apart. So Moses reached out with his staff over the land of Egypt, and the Lord directed an east wind on the land all that day and all that night. And when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. The locusts came up over all the land of Egypt and settled in all the territory of Egypt. They were very numerous. There had never been so many locusts, nor would there be so many again, for they covered the surface of the whole land so that the land was darkened, and they ate every plant of the land and all the fruit of the trees that the hail had left. Therefore, nothing green was left on tree or plant of the field throughout the land of Egypt. Sounds pretty terrifying, right? And in fact, it is. And it's hard for me to say whether whether any of the many locust infestations that have come since then were as bad as this one. Every several years, every 15 years or so, unlike cicadas, locusts don't come on clockwork. But fairly frequently, there are major infestations. Most recently, 2019 to 2021 has been a major infestation through eastern Africa. It has decimated crops. A swarm of locusts can take a field of soybeans or peanuts and just strip it down to the roots within a day. And I think especially when you're talking about farmers who aren't doing the massive industrial agriculture that we see throughout eastern Washington and through most of America, but when you're talking about individuals who are building their livelihood off of a single little piece of land, it can be absolutely devastating. As one might guess, during this time frame, dealing with this and coping with this has been complicated by the COVID pandemic. And so in eastern Africa, the ability to respond to this infestation has been very challenging. And so this has contributed to major food insecurity in Yemen, Somalia, and Ethiopia, especially over the past several years. So the infestation was sort of at its peak around October 2020. It's gotten under a little bit of control right now. This infestation kind of emerged in Western Africa, made its way in Mauritania, made its way east. And there's an organization based out of Italy, I believe, that basically tracks locusts and tracks locust swarms to be able to anticipate, to be able to intervene through pesticides and other types of control measures. But in general, they're very hard to manage. It's a very hard population to manage. And so, So yeah, so it's one of these things where on the one hand, I'm a firm believer in the beauty of the scientific enterprise in of itself, understanding the world around us for gaining that insight. But for certain creatures, gaining better insight of how and why they do the things that they do can also help us as a community to be able to respond appropriately when these creatures might affect our livelihoods. So here is a desert locust. So this is the little creature that we're going to be talking about today. I'm curious, what do you notice about this guy?
It looks like a grasshopper.
It looks like a grasshopper, yeah. What's different from a grasshopper?
Color?
The color's a little bit different. Yeah, so this guy's got bright yellow, dark black spots.
Looks like the wings are see-through.
Yeah, the wings are a little see-through.
Are the feelers shorter?
I don't know. That's a good question. Relative compared to a grasshopper, you mean? Yeah, I'm not sure. But yeah, they're not the longest. These guys are about 3 inches long, so they're pretty big. They're a pretty big bug. So this particular locust is in what scientists call its gregarious phase. That sounds very friendly, right? It's a very gregarious grasshopper. The gregarious phase is actually the phase that we're probably the most fearful of as humans. So the gregarious phase is the phase that grasshoppers go in when they are in this swarming behavior. So in the gregarious phase, they change color. They transition from their solitary state, where they're basically indistinguishable from other grasshoppers. In their solitary state, they are truly solitary. They avoid other grasshoppers. They move around on their own. They avoid other locusts. They move around on their own. They live their own lives. They eat some food, and they'll go through their life cycle. They can go through multiple life cycles in the solitary phase. In the gregarious phase, they swarm with other locusts. They're attracted to other locusts. They also go through a shift in their appetite. So in the solitary phase, they avoid plants with toxic compounds, as one might do. You don't want to eat things that are toxic to you. In the gregarious phase, they actually shift their appetite and begin to prefer food, plants with toxic compounds. And actually, I've got a bit of a typo here, but they're not non-migratory in their solitary phase. They still migrate in their solitary phase, but their migratory behavior changes rapidly. Such that in their gregarious phase, they will fly in these massive swarms together, seeking out new food, and ultimately devastating crops.
So what causes the change?
That's the question. What do you think? What might cause the change?
Climate, lighting.
Yeah, lighting, food supply.
What's the lifetime of a locust?
That's a good question. Individual locusts are a few months. Yeah, like 3 to 6 months, I believe. I should double check that to add a little star on that.
Is there the same number of them in the solitary phase as the gregarious? Or
you mean like within a particular area?
Yeah, what creates the huge quantity of,
yeah.
Is that a gregarious
aspect? No, y'all are onto something. So one of the key things is that locust swarms emerge following periods of rain on the tail of drought. Okay? So when you have long periods of drought and then massive rain, new rains, monsoons and what have you, it's after these rains come is what typically triggers locust outbreaks. So one of the issues, with infestation in East Africa, it was exactly this: was that there were in 2019 there were some the winds shifted. There were some monsoons that came up from the Indian Ocean, bringing kind of surprise rain into East Africa. This is great for a farmer. As a farmer, man, now you've got rain. Now your crops are gonna grow. Locusts get pretty excited about that too. So if we can put two of them together, that, you know, this isn't necessarily just like time-based, right? It's not like cicadas, which have this like 17-year clock and then come out and go back into their kind of hibernating behavior. But instead, the locust swarms are being triggered by periods of rain. So what's triggering this change to this swarming behavior? What it ends up being is crowding. So simply crowding locusts together. So if I take a bunch of locusts in the solitary phase, I put them in a box so they're all super close to each other for 4 hours, and they'll start going through a transformation into their gregarious phase. That's all it takes. So you squeeze them together in a box for four hours is all it takes, and get them in those tight quarters, and they'll toggle into this gregarious phase. So being in close confines seems to be the key. I've included the actual data on the right here, but we basically have kind of three candidates that this paper proposed as things that might trigger this behavior. It could be visual, maybe seeing other locusts and being visually exposed to other locusts is how they sense that crowding. It could be olfactory, smelling each other and smelling pheromones, smelling other locusts could trigger it. Or it could be tactile, just like you're getting bumped, right? You're touching each other. So what do you think? If I get a show of hands, we'll raise your hand if you think visual is one of the main cues. Okay, everybody thinks visual. Okay, what about olfactory? Okay, I've got a few hands for olfactory. What about tactile? A bunch of hands for tactile. So the data is a little bit more complicated. So what's being plotted here is after this experiment where they're only exposed visually in close, you like keep one animal isolated and then you have the other ones nearby, like through a glass. What's the fraction if they only have visual cues versus only have olfactory cues versus have tactile cues, or all the combinations? So each of these plus signs means that, you know, this one we've only got visual, this one we've only got olfactory, this one's visual and olfactory. What we're plotting here is what's the likelihood that the locusts remain in the solitary state. Okay. So if they only get visual cues, they stay in the solitary state. If they only get olfactory cues, they stay in the solitary state. If they don't have any cues, they stay in the solitary state. However, if they have tactile cues, no matter what, they'll toggle into the gregarious state. Similarly, though, if they have the combination of visual and olfactory cues, that's enough to toggle them into the gregarious state as well. So there seems to be kind of two separate mechanisms. There's like a tactile mechanism that can toggle them into the gregarious state, or there's this combined visual olfactory that can toggle them into the gregarious state.
Is there a way to toggle them back?
That's a good question. They do toggle back. They will toggle back. I don't know what the research is on like how to do that. It might just be time.
Social distancing.
Yeah, social distancing. Exactly. Yeah.
If someone's just having the olfactory sensation, are they getting something that is smelling all the time, or just emitting something at certain times from the other ones?
That's a good question. Yeah, that it might trigger
the person. Touch, that emits a chemical or something.
No, there definitely could be something combination. Yeah, exactly. Biology is complicated. These things interact with each other in ways that aren't always easily simplified in this kind of a study. Yeah, no, I think that you're exactly right. I don't know what the answer is to that. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good question. They do hear. I believe my understanding, I'm spitballing here a little bit, but I'm pretty sure that similar to like grasshoppers and crickets, that they actually hear through their front legs. But yeah, I don't know if the extent to which that contributes to this. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. What is a visual cue? Are they looking at?
It'd be seeing other locusts.
So they have to see other locusts, hear other locusts, or touch other locusts.
Yeah.
It's not other cues.
Yeah, exactly. So if they are simply touching other locusts, that's enough to toggle them.
But if they touch an elephant, it doesn't.
But if they, well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that in a second. We'll get to that in a second. Yeah.
Does it matter whether the other locusts that they're either seeing or touching are in the toggled state, the gregarious state, or they're not?
That's also a very good question. For this, it does not, for this study, but because this was all for solitary. But it is an interesting kind of piece of the puzzle of what's going on. So this is basically what our, this is a schematic of kind of what a locust body and nervous system looks like. Their antennae are primarily for smell. They've got their big old eyes that are for sight. They have touch sensors on various parts of their body, but one of their main touch sensors is on this, on their hind limb right here, on this top part of their hind limb. Many insects, in addition to having a true brain, also have sets of ganglia down their abdomen. And so these ganglia are sort of, they're almost like mini brains. They're like mini brains that a bunch of localized processing happens. For humans, most of, we have a little bit that, like reflex stuff that happens in our spine, but the vast majority of our processing, of our, computation of processing happens in our brains. Each of these ganglia ends up kind of corresponding to particular parts of their body and kind of control certain things independently. One of the interesting things is that another study kind of dove into this more and kind of asked this elephant question. And basically, what they did is that they touched different parts of the locust body for 5 seconds, once a minute, for 4 hours. And said, okay, if I just poke at the hind leg or I poke at the abdomen for 5 minutes, for 5 seconds every minute for 4 hours, do they toggle into the gregarious state? And for this, for the hind leg up here on that thigh portion, that will almost guarantee that they'll toggle into the state. So just poking them on that limb for 5 seconds, once a minute for 4 hours, and you'll toggle them into that state. I don't remember exactly what the study was. It's
like a
tweezers. Yeah, it's something like tweezers or something in the, probably some poor graduate student sitting there with their tweezers, or maybe they had like a little, but this is automated, this is purely mechanical. Yeah. So one of the things though, where this interacts though with your question about the gregarious nature and like, are they with others that have already gone through this transformation? Remember how I said that they become less averse to toxic compounds when they're in their gregarious state? They also shift toward like cannibalistic behavior. Like they'll start to eat each other. They're just incredibly voracious. And where they bite each other is on those hind legs. And so it also seems to be that, and so you'll have these like solitary ones that are trying to get away. The gregarious ones are like biting at them and biting at their hind legs. And then they kind of go through this like Jekyll and Hyde transformation. And so it seems to be that might have something to do with like fundamentals of like self-defense and whatnot also that shifts them into this new zone. So let's see, I'm trying to remember so as an example of like what the type of thing that this might look like in the laboratory, what they're showing here is a diagram of a box. There's a clear panel on the left side of this box, and there's a bunch of gregarious locusts on the other side of that glass. And then you drop a solitary locust or a gregarious locust in the middle there, and you can watch what they do and how long they spend on each side. And if you've got a locust that is in the gregarious state, then they will start moving and trying to swarm and gather with those other locusts. Sorry, the solitary locust will try to get away. And then this plot is just showing how I can't remember the details, but for each of these different points is different sets of these combinations. I think that one point is for if they have like have done the physical stimulation, another point is for for each of those points is different triggers, you know, different ones of either the physical stimulation or the olfactory and such. And then 1 hour in, putting them in this box, seeing what they do. 2 hours in, putting them in this box, seeing what they do. And so after, for basically all conditions, after 4 hours of this stimulation of trying to transition them, they'll start to transition over. Okay, so we've put together a little bit of a picture that that stimulating and poking this, you know, this rear part of their legs can trigger this massive change in their behavior. How in the world does that happen, right? Like, how in the world can this transition take place? The answer seems to be serotonin. So serotonin is a neuromodulator. We have it in our brains. Most creatures have it in their brains. When dealing with insects, we have to be a little bit careful, or basically anything non-mammalian for that matter, certainly non-vertebrate animals. That the way that evolution has picked up and hijacked what neurotransmitters do varies. There are many fundamental chemicals like serotonin that have totally different effects in vertebrate animals versus humans. But one of the this is a study that looked at dissected out this little ganglion right here, the one that the behind leg goes into, and looked at the amount of serotonin that could be extracted, that was being expressed in that area during these phase changes and during these transformations. And what they saw is that that for you know, by basically, you know, going through this process, seeing for every individual locust, how did they, you know, were they tending toward the gregarious group or were they avoiding them? That could be, and for each of those, depending on where they were on this spectrum of being more solitary or behaving more gregariously, and then measuring the amount of serotonin in that little ganglion. What they saw is that overall there's an increase in serotonin in this ganglion when they would go through that process. Similarly, then they said, okay, well, can we control this? Like, can we add serotonin in? Because if we can add serotonin in, then that gives us more evidence that this is actually like controlling it, that we don't even need to do the electrical stimulation or mechanical stimulation, electrical stimulation of the nerve. We could just toggle them into this gregarious state. And sure enough, that's what they show. So by adding serotonin, they tend to shift to that particular ganglion. They can tend to shift the locus into this state versus controls, and also receptor agonists, which is like a different chemical that just makes the existing serotonin bind more readily. They can also shift the locus into this state. So there's something very interesting going on here in this physical stimulation of the legs that it starts to move and starts to transform the animals into this gregarious state.
So you're probably going here, but is there anything about serotonin inhibitors transferring them back from the gregarious
state? Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, that's a good question. I was not going there. I think that's a really good question, though. Yeah, I haven't pulled the thread on that transition back state. But this is a good, I mean, this is a, like, as people are trying to, like, build out interventions and, like, dumping pesticides and on, like, fields of crops and stuff, like, if there's something, you know, that could be a more targeted intervention, it could be, like, way more, way safer, perhaps, for the environment than other approaches.
Does it have anything to do with length of life? I mean, are the gregarious longer lived?
No, they all... Not to my understanding, yeah. They can transition from the gregarious state at any point in their life cycle to and from. It's not particularly...
What's the average length of life?
It's like 3 to 6 months. They're not very, they don't live very long, yeah.
Does reproduction happen in this?
It can, gregarious? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can.
I was just wondering because there's swarms and I'm just thinking, well then...
Right, yeah, but I think that's just it, yeah, then it just, like, becomes, like, even more reproduction, and so it just becomes this snowball effect.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. The exact connection now between, like, you know, this serotonin out in these ganglia and what's actually kind of, like, going on in their brains is kind of hard to know. Some things that we do know is that their brains get bigger in this transition into the gregarious state. Now, they grow a little bit just into the gregarious state overall, but even if you control for that, their actual brains are larger. So these images aren't great, but what this is showing, this is these are four different views of a locust brain. Basically, the top one is like a 3D rendering. The middle one is a particular stain that shows the difference between cell bodies and like neural connections. The neural connections are the ones that are more purple. And then this one is basically the same as the second one, except it's been colored based on different regions of the brain, known regions. And then this bottom one is just kind of some different slices through it. To give a sense of scale though, this little white bar down here at the bottom that little white bar is the 1 millimeter scale bar. So these brains are tiny, they're super, super tiny. But even so, I just noticed the stuff down there. I should figure out how to turn that off, because that's super annoying, especially since they can't connect. Okay, sorry. Let me finish my thought here. So one of the key things, though, is that their brains are different sizes. So if you look at basically the left sides and the right sides of these images, the left side are from animals in the solitary phase, and the right side is from animals in the gregarious phase. So you can kind of see by eye how the right side of these are overall bigger. And the researchers who did this, you know, they went through basically region by region and, like, carefully calculated, you know, what's the tendency for each region to shift. And some of the regions that change the most are areas like the midbrain here, which are like higher processing areas. So these are areas that are getting a lot of different sensory information, pulling it all together, versus way out here, that these two big things are the optic lobes. And so their eyes are just past those. The things that are closest out to the eyes aren't changing that much. They're not like, it's not like their eyes are getting bigger. But the higher areas that are processing that information are getting larger. This is, in general, more social animals tend to have larger brains. So this might be something that helps them to be able to mediate their kind of newfound social lives. I think it's still somewhat speculative about what exactly is going on here, but we know that there's some very fundamental changes that are happening. Yeah?
Is it known if the brains get larger because they have more cells or larger cells?
That's a good question. I don't know. Yeah, I don't think that it's known yet. This particular study was just from a couple of years ago, and it was only looking at the size. But I think you're exactly right. That would be a natural next step.
Because, of course, for us humans, trying to grow more cells could be an important advancement for nerve damage.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So, kind of shift a little bit. So we talked a little bit about what stimulates these changes, what they, and it seems to be that the researchers who are focused on these locus are starting to tease apart, some of the mechanisms, like what's actually going on here, what's causing this behavior. So I want to talk a little bit about how locus actually migrate. So if we pop back to our quote from Moses, when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. This is pretty correct in the gregarious state. So when locusts are in their gregarious state and in this swarming state, they basically follow the wind. So the wind, they are in a pocket of vegetation. They're getting tons of food. They're just, they're laying eggs. They're growing like gangbusters. They start bumping into each other. They get this big, huge swarm. The juveniles will hop. The adults will fly. And then when the adults fly, they basically just go where the wind takes them. However, in the solitary state, and just more generally, locusts do a seasonal migration as well. So what this is showing is a map of spring breeding grounds for desert locusts. So kind of up here in the northwestern region of Africa, down here in the Horn of Africa, kind of throughout the Arabian Peninsula and into Asia and Pakistan, tends to be their spring breeding areas. Then there's a few arrows right here that kind of show that in the spring, then they start to migrate down into Central Africa. From there, then they expand and move back north. There's a couple of kind of winter breeding areas, and then the cycle kind of returns. What's interesting, though, is that their migratory movements aren't necessarily driven by the wind. So a big aspect of their migratory movements have to do with the inter-something convergence zone. Cannot remember the word. But through Central Africa, is the ITCZ, the inter-something convergence zone, which is basically where... Intertropical convergence zone. Thank you so much. So the intertropical convergence zone, this is basically where the prevailing winds are going against each other. When you look at prevailing winds of... between the tropics. And so so what you have is you have prevailing winds coming from the north down from Europe, hitting winds coming from the south, and this is what causes like monsoons and such through sub-Saharan Africa, through Western Africa. And so in kind of the early spring, summer, the locusts migrate from their breeding grounds, kind of in northern Africa, down to this area in more central Africa. There's a little bit of northward migration later in the summer. There's a major shift toward the fall of where the monsoon season goes away, and the ITC, the intertropical convergence zone, shifts further south. And then during this time, they then migrate back north. And that migration back north is against the prevailing winds. So that migration is not just driven by the wind. So how do they tell which way is north? Right? You got a little buck, it's this big. How do they know which way is north? Part of it's the sun, and that basically mostly boils down to the sun. Well, this is our best guess. I'm going to talk tomorrow a little bit more in depth with this, with respect to monarch butterflies, because even though they're evolutionarily, have not been related to locusts for millions of years, they seem to have a very, very similar mechanism for how they do this. But basically, locusts, butterflies, dung beetles, some ants, all have they call it the dorsal rim. It's a special little thing on the top of their eye. So this super fuzzy picture is looking down on the top of a locust head. And this little piece of, this little black part of their eye right here is the dorsal rim. And this is an area that's very sensitive to polarized light. It's kind of an interesting, weird quirk of how light from the sun interacts with the atmosphere that a bunch of animals can use polarized light as a cue to help them figure out which way is north. So I'm going to talk about that in a lot more depth tomorrow, but it seems that locusts have this mechanism where they can leverage the sun and polarized light in order to identify direction. So, what's changed since Ferran? Oh, sorry, you had a question.
Well, I was wondering if the polarization effect changes depending on what time of day it is.
It
when
does.
It affects when they migrate.
It totally does. Well, the first part definitely does. It becomes a challenging piece. I mean, if you think just in general about the sun, if you're relying on the sun to tell you where to migrate and you're trying to go north or south, beginning of the day, the sun's over there, at the end of the day, the sun's over there, right? So how are you going to tease these things apart? And so, yeah, time of day becomes an absolute critical piece of this. And the short answer, the short answer is that in butterflies, it seems to be the case, and folks have started to figure out the mechanism of how butterflies account for time of day in being able to do this calculation. Probably the same thing for locusts. I'll dive into more depth on what exactly is going on in tomorrow's talk. So what has changed since Ferronic times? Just 2013, there were locust swarms through Cairo. That they were dealing with, but what's changed?
Climate.
There's been major climate changes, and so if we look at North Africa today, there's a satellite image. Big brown area right there is the Saharan Desert. The largest desert in the world, absolutely massive. And down here through this area are the tropics and the rainforests of
Saharan. Your cursor, is it? Am I just blind or?
It's like way down here. Yeah. Yeah, you're not blind. Actually, what I should probably do is I should probably use this.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. Okay, that's better. So up through here is the Sahara. The modern state of Egypt is sort of like this-ish. The ancient state of Egypt was mostly along the Nile. And then up here is the Levant, and so this is kind of our key region for most of biblical history. So what has changed in this area since Pharaonic times? To what extent, I guess, the question that motivated me to kind of dig into this a little bit is were locust swarms more common then than they are now? Was this more of an abnormal thing for it to have been made into the Bible as one of the plagues? Or was this a common enough occurrence to have been something that was likely to be have been reported and captured? Moses is, there's no historical record of Moses beyond what is in the Bible. However, biblical descriptions of ancient Egypt place Moses around having lived around like 1400 BCE, which puts him kind of in the early middle part of the New Kingdom of Egypt. So 10,000 years ago, so well before Pharaonic times, is a period that ecologists refer to as the African humid period. So this was a time when the ITCZ, this convergence zone, was farther north. And what it meant for this convergence zone to be farther north is that the winds that blow in rainfall from the South Atlantic and bring the monsoon into Central Africa would have extended much further north and would have extended grassy woodlands in brown, wooded grassland in purple, much farther to the north, way closer to this area that is ancient Egypt. And if you recall, when we were talking about kind of the migratory patterns and the seasonality of breeding grounds for the locusts, this area down here in below, kind of near the ITCZ, was a key breeding area for locusts. So presumably, 10,000 years ago, if there were locusts around 10,000 years ago, which there certainly is likely given their evolutionary life, this would have been prime breeding ground for them. Would have been this area that is now kind of further up in the Sahara. So what does that mean? So what does that look like? So today the Sahara looks something like this through through the most open areas of the Sahara, whereas kind of sub-Saharan savanna looks more like this. Grassy, open, still quite dry, but with a lot of trees, and intermittent rains. So at kind of the two extremes of 10,000 years ago versus today, there were certainly changes that took place. There's also some interesting evidence from the historical record in ancient Egypt, ancient Egyptian tablets that show megafauna, that show lions and gazelles and giraffes and things that don't exist in Egypt today. And this kind of historical record has been corroborated by archaeological evidence, looking at archaeological sites throughout the Sahara and identifying and finding key predators and other kind of large mammals that currently live in sub-Saharan Africa, that historically were throughout the Sahara. And so what this plot here is showing is a bunch of different species. So up top here are various carnivores, and then down here are other mammalian species. And what's being plotted here is time. So present day is off to the right, and we can see kind of key periods for kind of our modern historical period, the New Kingdom. So this would be like Moses' time right through here, the Old Kingdom of Egypt, and then Archaic and pre-dynastic Egypt before that. And then what's being plotted is for each of these creatures, what is the likelihood that these archaeologists estimate that creature was extinct in the Sahara by that time? And so what we can see is that basically for any column, the more white you can see, the more likely that creature was around. And so you have, throughout this time period, of this shifting climate, you're losing a bunch of these keystone species and these species in the ecology. What's causing this climatic change? It seems to mostly be what the prevailing, the dominant theory is that it's the Earth's magnetic pole. That there's been a shift in the magnetic pole that has shifted the winds and where that ITCZ lies, and that this has been the dominant shift for the expansion of the Sahara. There are a couple of folks out there that have pointed, though, to the effect of human behavior on this space too, that might have helped to contribute to this. So if you imagine, especially at if you imagine the grasslands at the edge of the desert, you know, where food is sparse, that folks herding goats and kind of human agriculture and human cultivation likely impacted the land. But the leading theory is that these changes were not anthropogenic, but instead have been caused by the shift in the winds.
Are they gradual or sudden, this kind of change?
That's a really good question. One of the studies that I was reading up on, and I think it was this one that pointed to. It's hard to get the record, right? Like, it's hard to know what the timelines were of some of these changes. So one of the things that this study was trying to do was to get to that question by looking at these kind of keystone species and the rationale is that if you have a lot of species that are dying around the same time, then there might have been a very fast change at that time. And so this study kind of pointed to pieces of this as being key aspects of this. Yeah.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. I think about the locust ones in the story of Exodus.
Yeah, yeah.
I also, when I hear locusts, I think about the Little House on the Prairie books.
Oh, okay.
Right, because there's these periodic locust swarms, right? That pod loses all his crops, and then they have to move from Minnesota to South Dakota or whatever.
Yeah.
So two questions. One is, are those the same kinds of insects? And two, why don't we have those now? Is it just simply because of the use of pesticides?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let's see, on number one, not the same species.
Okay.
So the species that we're talking about here is the desert locust, something gregario is the scientific name. There are a bunch of different locust species, though. And I know that there's another well-studied species that's in South America. I don't know about those locusts, though.
Okay.
I'm not sure. That's a really good question. This species, though, you know, that they when they're in their gregarious state, they capture the winds. These ones have gone across the Atlantic and ended up in the Caribbean during outbreaks. They've ended up in the UK. So like the winds can blow these guys pretty far. I just don't know whether they like take hold in these new areas. So, yeah. So on this sharp transition question, one of the interesting things and one of the arguments that these folks make is that because of the frequency of kind of changes in this area that's like 4000-ish BCE, this is also during the transition from the Old Kingdom to the New Kingdom in ancient Egypt, which was characterized by basically a lot of political turmoil. So that you had a lot of turnover of pharaohs, like the pharaohs weren't staying as long, and so it was kind of a very long period of a lot of political turmoil, which would make sense if you're having massive ecological changes at the same time. So.
What about the famine? Well, there's a biblical famine too, right?
Yeah.
So there's those kind of things could be that
too. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. 100%. There we go. So in summary, So locusts go through this switch from this solitary to this gregarious phases when their populations become overly dense, largely when they've found a great food source and they start reproducing like gangbusters. It's ultimately mechanical receptors on their legs that are triggering this transition between the phases, mediated by serotonin. This transition is also accompanied by a loss of aversion to toxic compounds in certain plants. They have specialized sensors on their eyes and brain regions that sense polarized light and basically provide a compass, and I'll break that down more tomorrow in the context of the butterfly. And it's very likely that kind of aridification of northern Africa over the past 10,000 years has kind of shifted aspects of these breeding grounds of the locusts. And that kind of this area where we see the breeding grounds today, you know, in the time of ancient Egypt was likely much closer to Cairo. Well, it was in Cairo at the time. It was likely much closer to Egypt and to the Nile Delta. So thank you very much. Yeah.
Oh, so I have two questions actually. So if they're averse to these toxic compounds, but then they start eating more of them, does that affect their lifespan or because you're eating more and more toxic compounds? So is that?
I'm not sure if it affects their lifespan. That's a good question.
But could it possibly be used as a way of controlling, killing them or?
To know that they're being like given stuff that they don't like.
And also, if you're going to use serotonin as a way to control the population, I mean that could be potentially harmful to lots of things, including
Exactly. Right? Well, and that's one of the key things. Two thoughts. I think with serotonin, it's a very baseline like foundational chemical. This is one of the issues that we have with like pharmacological substances going into our rivers and our waterways. Like the types of effects that they might have are very broad. These are like the building blocks of biology and how things interact with each other and work with each other. I've done work in the lab where if you are there are extreme versions of this. So for example, a pharmacological substance that just interacts with serotonin, probably not a good idea for exactly the reasons that you mentioned. You have lots of off-target effects, you have lots of stuff that you can't control. If you look at this other extreme of what I think is probably off the top of my head, I think it's probably one of the most successful like targeted specific interventions are the mRNA-based COVID vaccines. So these vaccines are being produced such that the receptor that they are targeting is not in the vaccine itself. Instead, what the vaccine contains is instructions for cells in your body to produce the receptor that then the immune system is resistant to. And it's done in such a way, and it's designed in such a way that it's only for a short period of time that your body actually kind of locally manufactures the vaccine. It's like a precursor to the vaccine. So I do think that there are possibly, I don't know much about like insect pesticides, but I think that getting a better understanding of like what's actually causing this, how can you control this, that it might be possible to combine it in such a way and have something where you're able to have the good stuff without the bad stuff.
Right. Short term.
So yeah.
From this, you mentioned that they have different plant preferences in the solitary and gregarious.
Yeah.
Are they equally damaging in both states or?
They're less voracious in their solitary state, they're less voracious in their solitary state. And there's also not as many of them, and I think that's really the main thing that causes them to go so crazy. And the other thing on the toxic compounds too, it's thought that the consumption of the toxic compounds also helps them to be more resistant to predators. That they're basically ingesting these toxic compounds and they themselves are now more resistant to predators. And that's part of the reason that they then toggle into these like bright colors that that birds will be aversive to and such.
Yeah. In as much as they're used by humans, are they more toxic to humans?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. That's a really good question.
What good are locusts for?
No, yeah, everything has its place in the ecosystem.
They're serving some purpose.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure what the like what the ecological niche is.
So we do have a bottom line population locust, but then when the outbursts come,
yeah,
we do have locusts existing. We just don't know what they're good for.
I'm sure. I don't know what they're good for. I just haven't asked that question. I'm sure that they are good for. I'm sure that they fill a very important ecological niche. Like I don't doubt that whatsoever.
Are they a food source for people?
I'm not sure. Yeah,
I think they eat insects more in Africa.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
I was wondering if in, they'd eat them more, say, in the solitary. Do they become more bitter and gregarious?
Right. No, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Locust chow. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. So that is all I have. So thank you all for coming. It's been fun. If you want to show up tomorrow, we'll be talking about butterflies. We'll be talking about polarized light and sun compasses. If you don't want to come tomorrow, my feelings won't be hurt. If you'd rather take a hike. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, the last thing on the screen was a locust. That was